From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report. This first weekend of May, I'm Tyne Morgan, and here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes. Relentless rains and severe weather sweep across the country this week as planting progress gets pushed behind.
Looking ahead for the next 2 weeks, it does look like a very wet pattern and sometimes cool across the Midwest.
And the unforgiving weather could force more farmers to switch to soybeans.
Can't get real fired up to plant $7 soybeans.
That's as the flooding in Nebraska and Iowa is far from over. And in John's world,
big money, Bayer, and glyphosate.
U.S. Farm Report is presented by the all-new Chevy Silverado, the strongest, most advanced Silverado ever.
Now for the news, China's vice premier, who heads the Chinese president's negotiating team, is scheduled to arrive in Washington on Sunday. That's as trade talks are scheduled to continue between the U.S. and China. But optimism is gaining as new reports say China President Xi Jinping will visit the White House in June. Next week's round of talks fall on the heels of the Secretary of Treasury Steven Mnuchin and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer just back from Beijing, where they had discussions with the vice premier. The Wall Street Journal reporting the two sides have made progress on access to markets and how to roll back tariffs, but sticking points do remain.
I really think there's only a few things that remain to be done, and the primary one is the tariffs. How many should remain and what system will take place to reduce them, if not eliminate them. That probably can be handled in talks next week.
On Thursday, reports surfaced that President Xi is planning a trip to the White House the second or third week of June. As we've been reporting, analysts say a face-to-face meeting between the two presidents could signal a deal is done. Wiesmeyer thinks there's a 98% chance a trade deal will be signed soon, citing both Trump and Xi need this win. House Secretary Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer met with the president this week. The Democratic leaders urging the president to support a big and bold infrastructure package that goes beyond transportation. But they disagree over how to pay for it and what exactly would be included. The U.S. in 2017 had an estimated $836 billion backlog of highway and bridge capital needs.
We talked about a number of things we would do. Obviously, the roads and the bridges and the highways, obviously water, but also a big emphasis on broadband, that every American home, we believe, needs broadband.
Well, we're working on that. We don't necessarily have an idea how we fund it yet, and we don't know what the size is. Personally, I think it's got to be, you know, at $500 billion or less, south of $500 billion. There are some that talk a trillion. I don't think we can ever get there to $1 trillion. But we have to figure out how to fund it, and we're looking at everything's on the table. We also have to solve the Highway Trust Fund, the gas tax issue, so they'll probably be tied in together on how we solve that problem.
One idea about how to pay for the repairs, the nation's top business groups and labor unions have said they would support increasing the federal fuel tax, currently 18.3 cents a gallon since it was last raised in 1993. Well, the wet weather continuing to cause problems for producers hoping to get out in their fields, and more rounds of soaking rain on already saturated ground is making the situation even worse. This was Davenport, Iowa earlier this week. Crews evacuated people from several buildings and cars after a flood barrier failed along the Mississippi River. While producers haven't seen the extensive flooding that we saw back in March, it has remained wet and at times even cool. And as a result, we have excess soil moisture across the vast majority of the Midwest.
You might remember we had very slow planting for corn and soybeans through the end of April, but then things opened up in May of 2018. We actually saw nearly two-thirds of the corn planted during the first full 3 weeks of May, and almost two-thirds of the soybeans planted during the last full 3 weeks of May. That may not happen as quickly this year because looking ahead for the next 2 weeks, it does look like a very wet pattern and sometimes cool across the Midwest.
Well, Burger King's meatless Impossible Whopper is now going nationwide, and the craze seems to be gaining steam. The Impossible Whopper is made with plant-based patties. They are designed to look and taste like meat. It's topped with tomatoes, lettuce, mayo, ketchup, pickles, and onions. They have 15% less fat and 90% less cholesterol than regular Whoppers and 100% less beef. It was test marketed at 59 Burger King locations in the St. Louis area. Well, what goes on any burger? Meatless or meat full? How about avocados? Just last month, the White House's threats to close the U.S.-Mexico border spiked the price of avocados. And with Cinco de Mayo this weekend, a big weekend for avocado lovers, editor of The Packer, Tom Karst, joins us now. And Tom, you know, where do we set today? Big weekend for avocados, like I said. Where do we set today with avocado prices?
You know, they've come, you know, as you mentioned, in late March, the president said something about the border, which caused the prices to spike up near $60 a carton. Now they've backed down to about $44, still about $10 per carton, higher than the same time last year. I've talked to a couple avocado marketers, and they're going to sell a lot of avocados this weekend. And I think the price per avocado is going to struggle to get below a dollar, but you'll see that for smaller fruit.
But retailers aren't afraid that this kind of sticker shock will drive consumers away from buying avocados this weekend?
You know, it's such a big weekend. There's going to be 60 million pounds of avocados sold in just 1 week. And more retailers are also offering fresh guacamole to customers right at the supermarket. So that's another demand-shifting type of way to offer avocados.
Tom Karst, editor of The Packer. All right, when we come back, you know, Cinco de Mayo weekend, but we're also keeping an eye on weather. Brad Rippey thinks this cooler, wet pattern will continue, but does Mike Hoffman agree? We'll have our Farm Report weather next. Welcome back. Well, meteorologist Mike Hoffman joins us now with weather. Mike, May showers bring May flowers, is what they say, but apparently it doesn't bring much planting progress this year.
Tyne, you're absolutely right. We typically show the drought monitor here, but why? There's hardly anything across the country, at least the lower 48. The wet areas are the issue. A lot of the plains, a lot of the Corn Belt into the east, mid-Atlantic, all the way down into Texas now. We are seeing some very wet areas, and it's might be a while in a lot of those areas before we actually get to planting this year. There are still some areas of long-term drought, a few spots in the southeast. Those have been shrinking up, though. And northwestern New Mexico, the only spot left with what's considered a severe drought, nowhere else in the country is that the case. Here's the jet stream then. We do see a storm system kind of exiting, another one coming into the west. It's going to be a slow mover, so this will be pretty wet for the middle of the week, right through the middle of the country. And then that system is expected to kind of weaken as it comes toward the east. Still a ridge over the eastern half of the country. That at least warms it up. We could use some warmth because that helps to dry things out too. But if it keeps raining, that really doesn't matter. On Sunday then, this storm system expected to be a little farther north according to the models as we head into the early part of next week. So as we go through day by day on Monday, a weak cool front coming southward. We're not talking a lot of rain on Monday. These are going to be scattered showers, maybe thunder showers, and then Florida and South Texas seeing some showers and thunderstorms, mainly dry through a lot of those wet areas and warm from the southern plains into the southeast. Now, by Wednesday, there's that storm system getting going, fairly wet through the middle of the country once again. Those showers extend eastward into the mid-Atlantic, parts of the northeast, and into northern portions of the Rockies as well. On Friday we go, then you can see that storm system weakening, but moving into the northeast with scattered showers and thunderstorms along the cold front into the southeast, lingering back into the Four Corner region, and a little bit of rain and snow coming with a weak system diving out of western Canada. Here's my 30-day outlook for temperatures. I'm going below normal from western and northern Texas all the way to the Canadian border, above normal from Pennsylvania to Florida, back to eastern Louisiana, and also above normal in the southwest. Precipitation over the next 30 days. Unfortunately, I have to keep it going above normal. That's actually getting above normal now. You haven't been for a while there, Four Corner region, but most of the east, most of the Corn Belt, below normal though from western North Dakota back along the Canadian border and along the west coast. Tyne?
Thanks, Mike. Well, that forecast really isn't shaping up to be primed for planting, so why doesn't the market care about the lack of planting progress right now? Clinton Griffiths sets down with Allendale's Steve Georgie and Commodity Risk Management Group's Mike North next in South Bend.
Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. I'm Clinton Griffiths with Steve Georgie of Allendale, and we have Mike North, Commodity Risk Management Group. All right, guys, it's been a pretty dynamic couple of weeks looking at the markets, not necessarily in a good way, but in an interesting way. Let's start by talking about where do we sit at the end of this last week, and Steve, we'll start with you.
I think we sit a couple spots. You know, when you look at the grain markets, you've got a couple things that the markets are worried about. Obviously, the rain that's coming in.
Sure.
How much is that going to affect things? So what is that going to do moving forward? But that's more of a new crop issue. When we look at things, we also have an old crop issue. We've got 2.1 billion carryout of corn, 900 million almost of beans, and over 1.4 of wheat.
Right.
So when we look at that as a whole, we still have more of a supply issue. Export sales have been dwindling. But when we look at things as a big picture, we have two separate things to look at right now.
Yeah.
Going into this report May 10th, we need to be watching for that. They're probably going to kick the can on a lot of interesting scenarios that could possibly come up.
All right. Well, let's unpack a couple of those things. And Mike, I want to start with this whole planning issue because, you know, back in April, we were saying, don't worry about it yet. It's not an issue yet. It's mm-hmm. still wet. It's still one of the wettest stretches we've seen ever, maybe. And so where do we sit on whether or not it's time to worry?
Well, the reality is in April, you cannot trade
yes.
delayed planting because it's not delayed.
That's
and,
right.
And history is proof to us that even small windows can allow farmers to get in the field, get seed in the ground, and get the crop planted. The big question will be how we proceed in the next 3 weeks.
Okay.
You know, of the key planting period, there's about a four-week stretch from the third week of April to about the third week of May. We've got one of those weeks behind us. We're in the midst of the second week. How do we capture the last 2.5 weeks of that planting window and get 80% of the crop in? Because statistics tell us that if we don't have 83% of that in the ground by May 20th, we start to now put in question the U.S. yield. But as I tell everyone, even then it's not fully in the bag because right. we don't know what the summer weather is going to be.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
why it's very difficult for us to trade all of the weather stories that are out there, even as bad as it is right now.
Yeah. And Steve, whenever we look at the forecast shows this next week could see a lot more rain.
We do have a lot of rain in the forecast, and not only this week, but the extended forecast as well. As Mike was saying, what is it going to be on the 20th? How far along can we get? How much replant if guys had anything done already?
Yeah, I think replant's a good question.
And so those types of questions as we move forward, really, as you get these guys to the north already making decisions, whether or not am I going to go ahead and plant this corn, or am I going to move into beans? And so some of that already is starting to take place and starting to shift. So those are going to become more of a reality over the next few weeks as we get closer to this to the end of this month and as this rain progresses. So it's going to be very hard moving forward to get this yeah. crop done.
What about this conversation about corn versus beans? I think we see some of that impact in markets over the last week or two. Are we starting to hear this chatter of like, well, I'm going to be running out of this window's closing. I'm going to have to start moving from this 92 expected million acres of corn to maybe more beans.
Yeah, and I think that could gain some velocity as we go forward. The reality is the last 2 weeks, we have definitely moved away from a corn and soybeans discussion to a corn versus soybean discussion.
Interesting. Okay.
And you have seen some disparity there. The spread has widened considerably or narrowed depending on how you run the ratio. The reality for us is that in the coming weeks, if this wet weather pattern Steve alluded to continues and soil moisture continues to stay very elevated, then we will see guys make the shift towards beans. But here's the other question. If we see a magnified move lower in soybeans early, will guys, instead of planting soybeans, choose to go prevent plant? Because the other thing about May 20th, for a lot of the I states, that is the day when we cross into the late plant period. And now the coverage that's available in their policy is lessened as they plant deeper into the calendar.
We got about 20 seconds, last word on that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree, but I think the other thing that's going to be hinged on what's going on is this trade deal with China as well. We could talk weather all we want, but that is a big issue that's right ahead of us.
All right, that's a perfect setup for the next half hour. We'll talk a lot more about the trade deal. What does that mean for markets? And how does that shape the rest of 2019? Coming up in the next half hour, we have to take a break right now. Tyne Morgan will be back right after this.
Well, some good news for glyphosate this week, as EPA ruled glyphosate does not cause cancer. But a major manufacturer of glyphosate is seeing turbulent times, much of that dealing with the Roundup lawsuits in California. John Phipps has more in John's World.
Last week offered a rare event in the world of global business giants. German chemical and pharmaceutical behemoth Bayer was publicly rebuked by shareholders at its annual meeting. Led by the equally huge British investment firm BlackRock Holdings, which owns 7% of Bayer shares, a majority of shareholders passed a no-confidence vote for the board members and Bayer CEO. The principal cause was a claim that management failed to execute due diligence before acquiring Monsanto, a transaction which was completed last year. Since the takeover, Bayer stock has slid over 40%, almost certainly triggered by investor concerns over glyphosate lawsuits. Now, this vote is largely symbolic, but it is a clear and rare public embarrassment. While multiple lawsuits are underway, one California plaintiff was awarded $78 million, pending multiple appeals, of course. That action has spurred similar actions around the world, and over 13,000 suits are active now, a fact that was actually mentioned by the Bayer CEO in his report to shareholders at the meeting. Even though successful action requires proving glyphosate was at least a contributing factor to the illness, especially cancer, I think investors are doing the math on the probability of a disastrous outcome for Bayer. The reason is both simple and sad. We are moving away from science as the arbiter of truth. While it is present in many countries and cultures, here in the U.S., our individualistic ideals have led us to the point of allowing each of us to decide our own truth, applying or disregarding the best science available to fit our own ideological, religious, or political worldview. The result is like when nobody will agree upon or obey an umpire. The game doesn't get played or ends in a brawl. This engineer has long clung to the hope that basic pragmatism would correct this diversion away from Enlightenment values of logic and reason as the ultimate deciding factors, because the world just won't work very well without such standards. However, as we watch measles make an unbelievable comeback and we invent fables about GMOs, it seems to me that's the non-scientific world we're heading toward. And when people like BlackRock, who bet big money and can hire the best brains in the world, start hedging their bets on science winning the day, I take notice. Farmers need to start imagining farming without glyphosate. Even if it never comes to pass, such speculation might lead to some innovative new solutions on weed control, or at least maybe a new weapon to use against weed resistance.
Thanks, John. And he'll actually hit on farm bankruptcies and customer support later in the show this week. But first, some IH tractors that are quite the pair. Machinery Pete has Tractor Tales next.
Tractor Tales is brought to you by eTractor.com, Sullivan Auctioneer's new online equipment platform, eTractor.com. Hey, welcome back to Tractor Tales, folks. This week we have a pair of internationals from my good friend Danny Anderson in Pine Island, Minnesota. He plans on restoring these and shipping them to Austria.
885 and a 485 are the models of them. There's no serial number plates on them because they're experimental, you know, test tractors. These two tractors here are one of one ever built. They're tractors that International had built at the time of the merger with Case. They didn't go forward with these tractors. They would have been released in the fall of 85 with their new lineup. These tractors had been sitting there, and Case International donated these tractors to the University of Wisconsin River Falls, and they have been there ever since. And these tractors were just sold last October at an auction, and a friend of mine, an IH collector from Austria, bought these, and his name is Herbert Starzinger, and he is the owner of these two tractors now. And he contacted me last October and wanted to know if I could paint these tractors and restore them. So I'm going to hang my hat on these two are going to be my last two, because I've done between 400 and 500 tractors and I'm wore out. It's kind of an interesting story. These tractors have to be inspected by the Austrian government before they can be driven on the road. Everything has to have a license in Austria, and he has to carry a $250 million liability policy on anything that has a license on it. Not too many people can say I've restored tractors and shipped them to Austria, but I guess I can hang that one on my hat.
Thanks, Greg. Well, flooding is far from over in states like Iowa and Nebraska. Betsy Gibbon walks us through the damage and tells us why the road to recovery is still far from over. She joins us next for our Farm Journal report.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. Trusted, timely, tradition.
Well, it's just been crazy weather this week. While many states saw torrential downpours, flash flooding, and even severe weather this week, the record flooding from March is far from over. Betsy Gibbon shows us the recovery firsthand for not just landowners, but producers wading through those recovery efforts today.
Sandbags remain on the streets of Hamburg, Iowa, debris scattered across the tracks.
You know, usually it comes in and it goes out, but this one, it just won't stop.
Flooding still an issue, miles away from the Missouri River.
This is the field entrance, and this has been flowing since, you know, March 15th.
As some towns recover from the water, Hamburg remains a farming community in shock.
But as far as all this is concerned, I don't even know where to start.
Many farmers like Michael Stenzel in limbo as acres stay submerged.
This year we would have planted 4,200 acres and 3,200 of it is underwater.
As they deal with busted bins throughout the county.
The damage is done, now we gotta pick up. We gotta pick up, we gotta clean up, we gotta move on.
Stenzel losing more than half of last year's harvest. Economists say the total loss from the flood in Iowa is hard to calculate.
We've got a lot of estimates that have been made based on how many bushels of storage we think that are out there, but you don't know what's in each one of those bins, and you don't know how full those bins were.
The conversation of busted bins is even occurring in Washington, D.C. Lawmakers have yet to agree on a disaster aid package, and it's one farmers hope will include coverage for busted bins.
It was made clear to me that legislative language would be in the final bill that would update of what would be authorized to handle that bin destruction.
Farmers like Stenzel say they don't just want, but need.
Let's just say if I got disaster aid, I would be very, very appreciative, because this could mean the difference between if the Stenzel farming operation continues.
There's going to be a lot of challenges for a lot of those farms, and for some of them, it will be a difficult decision for, do I go back and farm again?
As woes of water linger with farmers in the area.
Water's still coming in from the breach, going south along I-29.
They realize the loss.
We're still sitting here without being able to pay 3/4 of our operating loan from last year.
But those like Stenzel are moving towards the future, but never forgetting the flood of 2019.
That's really the hard part, is just trying to figure out which way to go.
Greg Beebe considers himself fortunate after the Platte River flooded over its banks and onto his farm.
We didn't lose any livestock. The feed resources that we had were contaminated, and so we had to have discarded most of that.
The cattle okay, as the water went down.
They just kind of waited it out. There was feed in the feeders, and they kind of stood in water to eat, but they were able to stay put, and quickly the water went back down.
Yet the mess may follow into the summer. Uneven ground and fields turned to sand. Forage lost, as Beebe tries to makeshift his own with cover crops.
We have some going, and we'll use some of that crop ground just as temporary pasture to get us through this process. It's going to replace our typical pasture situation
A lot of that has silt on it and it won't be productive as pasture, so it needs to be replaced just to be profitable.
Livestock producers say while forage is an issue, rebuilding fence will be a large problem.
We're looking at a little over 7 miles of fence that's going to be for reconstruction.
Time and money added to many producers' budgets.
Well, this is going to be painful. A lot of people are, you know, producing at break even or below, plus or minus. So it's a tough time.
While everything can be fixed with time, Beebe wants the river to stay put for much longer. Reporting for U.S. Farm Report, I'm Betsy Gibbon.
Thanks, Betsy. Well, the financial impact of flooding is really weighing on producers right now, and so are these commodity markets. Clinton Griffiths restarts our marketing discussion next from South Bend.
Closed captioning is brought to you by BASF. Grow smart with BASF. We create chemistry.
Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. I'm Clinton Griffiths here with Mike North and Steve Georgie. All right, Steve, let's start with you. We'll talk about the wheat tour that happened this past week and some interesting numbers compared to last year.
We've actually seen some very good numbers from last year. So just better than a 47 bushel average, above the five-year average, more than what we had last year and the previous year. So when you get these numbers, things look really good. And yeah. You know, looks to be a little bit negatives yet for wheat.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, though. We did see a little bit of strength midweek in the wheat market, Mike. What is that weather related?
I think it's partly also a function of the corn market. You know, we've got corn starting to find a little bit of a rebound. Wheat's kind of marrying along with that and trying to move along in that space together.
Yeah, does the wheat tour, anything stand out to you?
Well, obviously, bigger yields shouldn't, you know, lead to higher prices. But I think as we look at the wheat yield, some of the offset to the smaller acres from last fall, and especially as we, you know, talk through inventories and where we're at with trade going through some of these deals, you know, all of that will play a part, no question.
Okay, let's talk about the trade deal with China. We hear at the middle of this last week that we may have some sort of announcement coming soon. The president from China is supposed to be here in June. And I say that because, you know, we keep moving the marker on this thing. Your reaction here as we talk about, again, getting something settled with China.
You know, I think that the market right now is getting sick of it. We need a deal done. Yeah. Not hearing, hey, things are really good. Hey, things are progressing or things are, no. We need to get something done. And when we say that, it was going to be March 1st. Then it was end of March. Then it was April. Now May. Now June.
Right.
How far are we going to kick this can? The reaction is going to be if something gets done. Don't tell me things are getting better. Show me that they're done. Show me that we have this, and that I think is what's going to end up making the markets. Every time you watch the news wires, next thing comes out, the market's kind of getting done with reacting to it. We need a deal.
Okay, what do you think, Mike?
Well, you ever seen the movie Groundhog Day?
I've seen it.
About the 17th repeat, they want to kill the groundhog, right? I mean, and that's where we're at in this discussion. If we cannot get a deal done, the market isn't going to even pay attention to the news that we're making progress.
Yeah.
That's old news. We've heard that story like 84 times now.
What would you like to see in this deal that you think would be significant, that would help move our markets and be a better deal?
Well, I'd like to see numbers on, you know, that quantify how much we are going to sell them. And the, you know, what would make it better is if it's in this marketing year or at the very least next marketing year, not some sort of we're going to buy so many metric tons over a 5-year period.
Okay.
Because that gets us nowhere.
Okay. Yeah. The same for you, Steve?
Yeah, but I think that is going to be the biggest focus is what kind of numbers do we get. When we talk beans and we look at the amount of carryout, we do need to get this shift into something else. So getting another store in there to come buy us, you know, getting a deal done, that shifts the mentality of the market. These funds right now we know are extremely short. Mm. And so what's going to take to get them to shift? We know weather's not doing it, right?
Right.
So is a deal with China going to end up maybe shaking them out or something? Because we started this almost a year ago, cutting NAFTA, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, getting into a trade war with China. Now we got something different. We need to get that done.
Okay.
And so with that, we'll see where it goes.
I've got about a minute left. Mike, last word on this. What are you watching as we go through the month of May?
Well, so we spent a lot of time talking about delayed plantings, rains in the United States. Let's not overlook the fact that South America is also getting rain. we likely are going to see increases in their crop numbers as we go forward. We're going to be playing that against the crop numbers that we see through May and into June in terms of domestic production. But laid into that is also the trade discussion that Steve was talking about, and I'm really watching the funds. I believe that that's where the powder keg sits for this market. If we can inspire them in any way to come out of that big record, massive short, and think about getting on the long side, that means we need to move 400,000 contracts of corn back out of their position and back into neutral territory, or to get even longer, more contracts.
Right.
That'd be
right.
The equivalent of them, you know, soaking themselves in gas and lighting a match.
Well,
right. That'll be what the market stands along the sidelines to watch.
All right. Very visual. Thank you both for being here. Hopefully that gives some folks some perspective. We're going to be back with more U.S. Farm Report in just a couple of minutes.
U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by DeLauro. New DeLauro fungicide for corn and soybeans can help you get the edge you're looking for to achieve personal best yields. DeLauro, keep raising the bar.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend we have a blast from the past, traveling the countryside with Andrew McCray.
It's arguably one of the most famous and memorable vehicles we've seen on television.
Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. The kinfolk said, Jed, move away from there. Said, California is the place you ought to be. So they loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is. Swimming pools, movie stars.
We have the original truck from the Beverly Hillbillies show. It is a 1921 Oldsmobile. It's the original frame of the car. And it was actually used in the show. It's the real car.
Although the show was mostly filmed in Hollywood, five shows were filmed at Silver Dollar City in nearby Branson.
And here come the Beverly Hillbillies.
It was that time that helped land the car in the Ralph Foster Museum here on the campus of the College of the Ozarks in 1976. The place has resided ever since. Some of the folks who used to ride in that truck still stop by.
Donna Douglas, who played Ellie Mae, came and she actually did an interview in the car. They sat in the car to do the interview.
Rumor has it that Buddy Ebsen, who played Pa on the show, also slipped in to see his old truck. Of course, there are thousands of others who come by here every year, but Abigail says many are surprised by what else is here.
A lot of people, that's all that they know is here, actually. They're like, oh, there's actual other stuff here. Yes, we actually have quite a large collection here.
The Hillbillies truck is just inside the front door, but there are three floors of exhibits to explore.
We have a very large gun collection. We have 1,200 plus guns on display on our second floor of the museum.
The museum is also known for its extensive music artifacts that concentrate on the Ozarks. And when you venture upward from the ground floor, you continue to find an amazing collection of items.
And then we have a really large taxidermy collection as well, and it spans from second floor up to the third floor, as well as a large collection of preserved butterflies that were preserved by a local here. And there's actually, I think, every species of butterfly.
It's this truck that brings most people here to this museum. However, for those who step inside, they're going to find a treasure trove of memorabilia from the Ozarks and far beyond. Traveling the countryside in Point Lookout, Missouri, I'm Andrew McCray.
A hidden treasure in Missouri. Who knew? Thanks, Andrew. Well, when we come back, John Phipps dives into Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies.
Your call is very important to us. Please hold.
Welcome back. Well, last week in our Farm Journal report, we dug into farm bankruptcies on the show and why Chapter 12 filings may not reveal the full financial pain in agriculture right now. But the conversation doesn't stop there. John Phipps has customer support.
Robert Donald from Moravia, New York, has a question regarding farm bankruptcies. The Chapter 12 law designed for family farm bankruptcy has a cap of $4,153,150. Farmers filing bankruptcy over that dollar amount do so usually using Chapter 11. These bankruptcies are not included in that list of 500 or so Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies reported on TV. If this is the case, what would the real story of the farm economy be to include these mega farm bankruptcies with the Chapter 12 bankruptcies? Robert, thank you very much for writing and for your question. Much of it was answered last week in Tyne's excellent report about the farm bankruptcies. Larger farm bankruptcies are impossible to sort out from other Chapter 11 cases, but as a rule, they create their own publicity in the ag media, and they have been relatively rare. The bigger question for me is if tracking farm bankruptcies is actually a good way to judge the farm economy. To begin with, the small numbers exaggerate changes in trends. Bankruptcies are a lagging indicator with a long delay, so by the time we see any sharp change, the economic conditions could be obvious to anybody or completely different. What I watch are three things: equipment sales, both new and used, land rents, and farm show attendance. All these are areas where farmers make cutbacks relatively early. I recommend following Machinery Pete for those equipment markets. AgWeb and other farm media have a steady stream of rent info, although those numbers are always incomplete and questionably representative. And when looking at farm show attendance, compare previous years and be careful to sort out producers from other industry attendees. You will notice I do not list net farm income, predictions, or actual, or land prices. This is not because they don't provide important data, but because they are slower to change and muddied by non-farm income and outside investment, respectively. For instance, farms with enough off-farm income to meet living expenses can struggle on for years with a money-losing farm operation. But there is another aspect about farm bankruptcies that troubles me more. Basically, whether making them easier is a good idea. One farmer's fresh start is another farmer's cost increase. I'll explain my thinking on this next week.
Thanks, John. Well, the wet weather is playing a role in planting plans, and one farmer says he's not too excited to plant $7 soybeans right now. But the price paying for beans could get worse. From the Farm is next.
From the Farm is powered by Kawasaki. Let the good times roll.
Well, they say 2019 has been a frustrating year for farmers. Already it would be an understatement. But it's not just from the lack of planting progress. It's also price pain. And the worst may be yet to come. A year of trials.
This corner of the farm right here was underwater.
And tribulations.
The only thing left sticking out here was the shed and the house and the bin pad over here.
As the remnants of the flood of 2019 are still there.
We've had to go out and do a lot of burning ahead of the corn planter. You know, there was places that there was 8-10 inches of corn stalks and soybean residue that had floated. You know, floated up and rafted up.
Just a month ago, Kastner and other area farmers were fighting off floodwaters. But after working tirelessly to get fields fit and pumping more than 1,100 hours of water off his fields, Kastner finally got in the field to plant.
Corn so far, we're calling it 100% right now. It's 100% of the acres we can cover after the flood. We still have maybe 400 acres that should have gone to corn that, you know, just still has water over it or conditions weren't right to be able to get on it to get corn planted, so we're looking to have to transition those acres into soybeans.
Kastner isn't the only farmer making major headway on corn planting last week. USDA's latest crop progress report shows Missouri farmers had 45% of the corn planted as of Sunday, a 29 percentage point jump from the previous week. And despite major progress, planting corn is still behind in the Show Me State, as USDA says average corn planting pace is 55%.
We're still behind. You know, we'd normally like to be planting beans by now. You know, we normally like to be planting corn by April 7th, and I think it was the 21st when we started planting corn, I think. So we're still behind, but we didn't finish up too bad. We worked around the clock and, you know, worked pretty hard to get those acres in.
Kastner watched nearly 5 inches of rain fall on these fields in just 2 days this week. As he says, already saturated soils is forcing their farm to switch 30% of their planned corn acres to soybeans.
We would have put more corn in probably. I can't get real fired up to plant $7 soybeans. So that's, you know, that's kind of been a decision factor in here as well, why we've worked so hard to get corn in the ground.
Castor's not alone in those sentiments. From the Mississippi Delta up through the northern Corn Belt, relentless rains could mean more farmers switch to soybeans, a move Standard Grain's Joe Vaklevic says won't be healthy for soybean prices.
The last thing that the soybean market really needs here in the U.S. is more acreage. We've got all the supply that we can handle at this point. Soybean carryout is expected to double year over year. When analysts go out into the 1920 marketing year, things could get even worse. If we end up with the trend line yield this coming growing season, I think you could find a carryout that goes from, say, 900 million this year up to well over a billion next year.
Vaklevic says the soybean market is in uncharted waters. And if the worst case scenario does plan out, he says you can't rule out the possibility of even lower soybean prices.
And you've got the projection for record carryouts, record stocks to use ratios, and we've still got prices that are above the lowest levels that we've seen in the past 10 years. So I do not think you can rule out more downside in the market. What sorts of prices could we see to the downside if this worst case scenario plays out? It's tough to say. Could it be something in the $7 range? Sure. Could it be something in the $6 range? I suppose that's a possibility. Now, to paint a positive picture, you know, you've got a record short fund position, and maybe that has to be covered at some point in time.
As Kastner catches himself growing frustrated with prices and weather, he says after the flooding in March, he's thankful to have a crop at all this year.
This has been a very rocky, very trying spring for us, and it's easy to catch myself getting frustrated at it, but you know, at the end of the day, when you look at where we've come and where we've got to, we're blessed to got done what we've got done.
We're also hearing from farmers in Arkansas and the Delta region who are having a hard time getting their rice planted this year. They're also probably going to be forced to switch to more soybeans. All right, that's all the time we have this weekend. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you for watching U.S. Farm Report. Be sure to watch us again next weekend as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Closed captioning is brought to you by BASF. Grow smart with BASF. We create chemistry. U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.